If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. Sally Wilson is a UK-based mixed media artist whose work has to be seen to be believed. With a background in sculpture, Sally's work is fearless and her creative approach is unlike anything I've come across before. She seems to simultaneously create multiple pieces of work but isn't afraid to destroy the work in order to produce better pieces. Sally's career started out in one direction, but a head injury gave it a dramatic turn and it left her unable to produce work for a while. This was the thing that started her on her journey into textiles, and it's interesting to explore how she has adapted to the new normal and yet still been able to produce work that's truly remarkable. In many ways, her work reminds me of the process that we saw with Kaz Holmes in Needle Exchange number 4, and I'd recommend you listen to that if you can do, but obviously wait till the end of this show. And do take time to see Sally's work on her website, because the pieces that she produces in textiles are only part of the story, and it is a story that you need to pay attention to. You'll find more details about Sally in the show notes, and I hope you enjoy the show. It's a cracking conversation, and the second part of that will be available next week. If you like needlework, if you enjoy these conversations, if you can share this with one person that you know who will enjoy it, I'd be truly grateful. Thanks for your time. See you next time. Enjoy the show. So, for instance, with you, obviously, you started out doing a degree in, like, sculpture. You come from a sculptural background, don't you? Which is why your pieces are so explosive. What happens in a degree in sculpture?
Oh, my God, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was, I wasn't very good at anything else, school-wise, and I just wanted to do art, and I ended up on a sculpture course, which is a long story because I'd never done sculpture, and I applied for it and got on because of my drawing, because I love drawing, and it was the best years. And the main things I did was welded metal, so that's really where it all started. And then I sort of fell into teaching. I came home and thought, what am I going to do? Ended up working at a sixth form, and I was there for 19 years. And in that time, I always kept doing my art. My art was really important. It was the one thing that I'd come home, forget college, and I'd do my own stuff. And also I felt it... it helped me be a good teacher as well, because being actively doing it helps you to process what they're doing as well, you know, and how they're working through their ideas. So it, and I have my own little workshop. So I have a workshop up at my mum's where I've got my welder, angle grinder, God knows what, and I absolutely, I loved it. But through college, I actually, you know, with the teaching thing, they want to send you on, God, loads of training courses. And a lot of them are really quite hideous. And so what I did, I asked them if I could do tactical training as part of my training courses, yearly courses. And I picked a really basic City and Guilds sewing. I can't even remember what it was called. And I did that for two years. And it gave me loads of ideas. But at that time, they weren't really doing that in college. They weren't really doing the stitch thing until later on. And then in 2005, I had a really bad head injury and I broke my drawing arm very badly. And it literally just destroyed my life, really, I suppose. I had to leave my job because I couldn't remember names. I couldn't remember what I was doing. I was struggling to deal with my life, full, you know, anything to do with my life. And I went through quite a long rehab with my local hospital, Pinderfields, and I was sent all over to see different specialists. But I suppose the most traumatic part was all of a sudden I couldn't do art because I'd lost my drawing hand. And they did lots of operations on it, and the surgeon said to me, we don't think you're going to be able to use it again because you really have damaged it badly. I'd lost sort of feeling in probably three of my thumb and a couple of fingers. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And they obviously potted me up. And I thought, what the hell am I going to do? And I thought back and I started to think about the City and Guilds, and I thought, I'm going to have to start drawing on a sewing machine. That's the only way I can do it, because it meant I could move the fabric around, but I wasn't having to do it directly. So I bought myself a really, really cheap Janome. I think it was a Janome that I started with. Bought a free stitching foot. And that's where it really started. And I think the first couple of images that I sent you were some of my early pieces. And literally all it was putting fabric applique on, textures with cut up wools and threads and all sorts of things like that. And I just started doing things, you know, things that anything that came to mind. I couldn't draw it, so I had to just basically create these pieces that it might have been about colour, or I did little images on them. And as I got better with movement, I could then improve a little bit of the drawing on it, you know what I mean? But really, that was the start of textiles, you know. Although I'd done the course, I didn't really get engrossed until something traumatic happened.
How rehabbed are you now? Obviously, that was quite a long time ago. What's your normal now?
My normal is probably abnormal. I have sort of things that affect me. So I have severe fatigue, which affects me differently on different days. I usually probably have a slot of maybe 3 hours where I'm probably more active and I can get my brain around things and I drive or whatever. But I have quite a long period, sort of. I suffer from sleep apnea. I have what's it called? My words are a little bit sometimes mixed up. I use the wrong words. When I write down, I miss words or a misspell, or I still have sort of things of dizziness. I think one of the biggest things, and I don't remember to do daily things. So I have lists all over the house and boards up, remembering to wash myself, eat. I think eating is probably a big one. I forget. I don't think about eating. I love food, but I don't think right. about it. And then I might get to 3 PM and I think, oh, I'm hungry. And I haven't thought about it. So I have to, I try very hard to write lists. My daily things, I have a diary that is chock full of the most stupid things, like wash hair or, you know. So, yeah, it's a weird one, really. I didn't think, I think you have this illusion that you're going to sort of come through and you're going to be back to a normal thing. And what I've realised is I'm actually a totally different person now. And I have no issues with that. I just have to deal with it in a different way, that's all.
Yeah. My wife runs a wheelchair service here, and the variety of people that she meets who've gone through similar things, it's quite profound.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think half of the struggle is holding on to a version of yourself that's no longer viable.
Mm-hmm. I did that for a very long time. For years, I couldn't cope with the person I'd become. I have a very good doctor nurse who I go and see regularly, and she's probably been one of the best things that happened, because she puts it into perspective. When I go and I'm crying, I cry a lot, and I go and talk to her, she doesn't sort of dismiss things, and she doesn't sort of go, oh, that's silly, you know. Makes me realize it's acceptable. I just have to know that how I lead my life is different now, and I have to have a lot more time to process things and to cope with things, I suppose, is the word. You know, I struggle with, like, meeting new people. I like to have someone almost like someone next to me. So my other half is brilliant. He met me after the head injury, so he doesn't know anything else. He lives in London. We have a great relationship. At some point, not at the moment, but I'll travel his way, he travels mine. And when I've gone into social situations, he's there and he sort of props up. You know, when I get a bit, oh my gosh, he helps me to sort of work through those difficulties, you know.
Your art, one of the things that struck me looking at it is there's such variety. Certainly, if you look on your website, you've got about 9 different strands of artistic output, from drawings to sculptures to relief work. But you don't, like, for some people, I feel like they compartmentalize their work, whereas to you, it's just the art, isn't it? You don't go, I make sculptures and I make textile work particularly, do you? You're in this sort of rolling process of artistic drive.
I think when I was first doing my work, I was a sculptor in my head. And then I think when all this happened, I realised actually I just create art. I just love art in all its forms. I love, I think part of the thing, because I couldn't challenge, when I had my injury, and then since on that rehabilitation, I realised I couldn't challenge myself in other ways because I were already challenged. So the art form became a way of challenging myself to do the unusual, to do the different. But I love doing all sorts of things, and I get bored very easily. So the reason I sort of combine things, I like to combine textiles with drawing. I like to then create sculptural forms, and the other thing I tend to do is when I start an idea, I'll probably produce 4 or 5 works from it that are all in different forms. And I think that's my way of control. It's being able to, because I can't control my life, I've got to control something. So I can control what comes from that. And I like to then develop something through stages and into different art forms. A project might take me a year, you know. So, for instance, I did a set of works that were London-based because obviously of where Andy lived. And I did a lot round Shepherd's Bush Green, and I did some in Piccadilly. And literally I think it probably took me over a year. I did about 5 pieces that were everything from drawings, textiles, sculptural work, and a lot of them bringing them together into works that had all that in them.
And do you find that, say, with those pieces, do they happen simultaneously, or do you do a drawing which then makes you think about a textile piece? Or is the crossover period smaller than that? Like, are they all happening at the same time, or does one follow another?
I start everything from drawings. I love drawings. So everything that I do is drawing-based to start with. Usually I'll start on one piece, but then as I'm creating that piece, other ideas are starting to pop into my head. So I write notes, I do little sketches, a lot. Half of my the beginnings of my work, I have a little set of notebooks, and literally all they are just line drawing pieces. And I've got hundreds of little pieces of paper where I've drawn a quick sketch on it, and that then will be put there until I finish that one piece, and then I start the next. So I don't tend to do more than one piece at a time, but the ideas are there, and obviously that's how they develop. The way that I sort of begin my process is I'll start with drawings, I go out and photograph, I'll sit and do studies on site, I then start researching on the internet, looking at images, at photos, anything like that. And I build up files for a particular scenario or piece. And then what I do is that if I haven't got enough, I'll then go back to the site, or in the case of some of my pieces, go to a particular museum, or, you know, so I like first-hand information. I think that is the key to all that I do. And I think without that, I would struggle with it, I think.
And it's a form of documentary by the looks of it, looking at some of the themes that you've covered. Are they sort of objective observations? Or, for instance, you did a series of pieces about Brexit, which to me is, that's a politically charged phrase from the get-go. Yeah. So are you saying something, or are you just providing an observation?
I think it's more of an observation, or it's more about my vision on that. So it's a difficult one. I did a piece about Jimmy Savile and who was the other guy, and it went down very badly, to be honest. I think I tried to put it into a few exhibitions, and literally, I mean, I'd done it in a roundabout sort of way. So I'd done it. It was a stitching, you know, and it had children's toys on it. And I used the idea of I used 2 dogs, literally, and the storyline through it. And funnily enough, nobody wanted to take it on and exhibit it. And
right.
I think that always, I think, like with the Brexit, or with COVID, I did quite a bit with COVID, and The funny thing is, I think sometimes when you do what is current or what is happening, what I find is there are pieces that galleries and don't seem to want to deal with. It's almost like it's too, maybe it's too in your face. I don't know. So I do play with current ideas. But unfortunately, all those are actually still in my house and are still sat there because it's like nobody wants to deal with them. Whereas the pieces where I deal with almost my upbringing, the environment around me, London or, you know, nature, which is a massive one for me. Funnily enough, that everybody likes them. You know, it's as soon as you go down the political or the there seems to be a little bit of a block, I think.
It's like they need a cooling off period or something. They need to know that it's okay to talk about these things because otherwise they don't want to kind of put a foot wrong.
Yeah. I think it's that thing that I wanted to sort of almost put out my view on something, but do it creatively. I get the feeling that it is not, it's almost a few years down the line. Maybe if I then resubmit, maybe it will take on a different. Who knows? We'll find out, won't we, in a few years' time. My biggest problem is that everything that I do takes a long time. Most of the places where you would exhibit have a deadline. So they go, this must have been produced in the last 2 years, or this, you know, there's always a deadline.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And my big, you know, if you're dealing with sort of galleries or big exhibitions, I am literally buggered because most of my work has taken a year to create. And then by the time I've created it and I'm looking for places to exhibit, I've passed the deadline. I'm not, you know, it's not current anymore, you know, which is difficult.
So they want new work, but it has to be about old news.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Or it's just the fact that you've created. I think they think that it's that's part of your past. But in my mind, all my, you know, my work isn't. I'm not commercial. I can't be commercial because I struggle with day to day, and I don't deal with my own ability to survive on my own. Very well. So to be able to become commercial, you have to be savvy and you have to keep up with things. And so I can't plough out work for the sake of ploughing out work. The work I create is created for my own sanity.
Let's talk about the Royal Cloak, the third place winner in our prize competition. Congratulations. Yes. One thing that's nice, particularly with this podcast, is when I put it on YouTube, I have like big pictures of the work. And so if people are listening, I'd encourage them to go and have a look, because I don't think that, I mean, if you can explain the work, that would be fantastic. I think people need to see it because it is truly a phenomenal piece of work. Can you talk me through it?
Yes. I started studying the shoe bill. And I actually did a piece for the Hand and Lock competition. And I found out, I sort of researched the shoe bill in detail, and it's an absolutely amazing bird. So I created this cloak to almost celebrate it. So you have the main area on the top, which I can't think of the word for it. which is a crest. And on the crest, you've got a catfish, which is what the shoebill eats. And then as you come out onto the wings, on one side it has all the animals that are a part of the landscape that the shoebill lives. So zebras and giraffes, and that all sort of is what on one side, and they're all and the shoebill is actually flying above the animals. And then on the other side is the hippopotamus, which I read that where the shoebill feeds in the marshlands, a hippopotamus inadvertently pushed the fish towards the shoebill. So they actually act as their survivors, which is brilliant. They actually create the environment for the shoebill to feed. And then I think there was a whale on it as well. And the whale is there because the shoebill has got the nickname Whale of the Land or something like that. So sort of through the design itself, you actually get the story of the shoebill, which is something that I really like doing in all my work. I don't do just a picture. I will have maybe numerous images, main images, details, and then there's usually writing within it, which goes back or it gives information about the past and the present and so on.
And did that come to you as a fairly fully formed idea? Like, what, I mean, A, what was it about the shoebill that drew you in the first place? But then do you get an idea and then does the research inform the actual execution of it, or was it fairly formed when you got there?
I was actually looking for, when I started looking for an idea, I wanted a creature, some sort of creature. But I don't like necessarily beautiful. I like something that's got character. And when I saw the shoebill, I thought, oh, my God, that is amazing. I've never, ever seen anything like it. And that started I think I got three or four different creatures that I looked at. And then I started to research them. And as soon as I started to research the shoebill, the information and the background to it was absolutely amazing. And I thought, I've got to do this. This is, you know, creating wings and things like that. When I did the actual 3D piece, I think that was probably one of the reasons I chose it. I also felt that I hadn't, because my hand hadn't worked for so long, and it gradually improved over a few years, I hadn't done any hand stitching for years, and never really anything of significance. I think probably when I were a kid, my mum used to get me to sew a lot. I used to make little purses and God knows what. And I thought, I would love to try hand stitching. And so the coat, the cloak was the first thing I've ever hand stitched properly, you know, done a piece that really tried my patience. So I tried all sorts. I obviously did on it, it's got free machine embroidery, I did that, the animals and things like that. I literally draw with stitch, so that were quite intense. And then the hand stitching, I learned loads of new stitches that I'd never even knew existed. I also tried gold work, which is bloody hard, that's all I can say. I'd like to do some more, but I think it's the one thing I would say I am not is I'm a perfectionist in that I want something to look good, but in terms I would say I'm a bodger. So when you look closely, you probably don't want to look closely. It's one of those where also at the front always looks, you know, I manage to do things so everything looks how I want it to look, and it has to be to a certain thing. But on the back, I quite like the backs because they are just, they're like me, the chaotic, like my life, I suppose. I suppose it is a little bit like me, although I don't look as perfect on the outside as on the inside. But the work is pretty similar to me, really, yeah.
I think we have to, you sort of downplay yourself a little bit here, because I love the fact that it was the first time that you did hand embroidery and then you went and won the Hand and Lock Textile Art Prize with said hand embroidery. But also The fact that not only did you make the cloak, but in that instance, you made the bird as well, and you gave it a fully, you know, embroidered beak and everything. I mean, I think this is one of the things that I'm impressed about, is that you're, background in sculpture clearly just sets you up and means that you can have like limitless creativity.
Yeah, I think I mean, at the moment I have a couple of pieces that I've had on the go for quite a long time, and they are both big drawings on board. Textile is starting to creep into them again, but I think I always want to go to the sculpture or want to go to relief work at some stage. So wherever I do flat work, I always feel like there's another piece that wants to come from it that is maybe somehow three dimensional. It's funny, isn't it, how your ideas, my ideas don't stay in one place. I sort of start one thing and I think, oh no, I should be doing that, you know. And
I feel like that's something that comes across when you look at some of the work, again, thinking about, for instance, the Brexit series, and thinking about the way that you use sort of found objects and unorthodox objects in the work. It feels as though you have an idea and then new inputs will just come along, and there's a certain amount of, you just go, well, I'm sure I can make that work. And you, like you say, you kind of bodge it because you don't go, oh, I can't include that thing. Like, there's no barriers to entry with your work.
I think one of the things that, what I do a lot is I tend to cut things up a lot. So I will start a piece and within days, or even maybe a couple of weeks, I think, oh my God, that doesn't fit the composition I thought it was going to do. And so I am very, very brutal, I suppose the word is. I'm brutal with my work. So I can, I had a piece that I did that was, there was an old lady, and it had my mum flying in it, and I've got spiders and things like that, and all sorts of things that related to it. And it probably took me about 3 months. And the other day I thought, I really don't like that piece. And so it's now become, I think it's about 10 pieces of fabric that have all been cut up, which then may at some point become something else. And I think that's probably the biggest part for me, is I'm not very sentimental. There's very few pieces where I actually don't like a lot of my work. So I will live with it for a while, and then if I get to a point where I start to see the mistakes and the things that didn't work, I then will deconstruct and start again. So I've got quite a few things where I've photographed they were pieces, but have now disappeared into bags and metal containers and God knows what. So I do sort of lose a lot of what I've created through destruction, I suppose is the word.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.